I have no relationships. Okay, don't try to read this slide. I'm going to give you an overview of this slide. All right, what my job is today, because we had got a chance at the beginning to do some introductions, and not everybody was here at the time, but we have people who are clinicians, we have people who have started programs, we have people who work in government, we have people from diverse disciplines and backgrounds in the room. We probably don't have anyone from foundations, do we? So we do. Which foundation are you from? Great. So you do a lot of this work. But what I'm going to try to do is help you all see yourselves in the world of advocacy and policy and understand what your power is. You are the experts, and you have the research, the knowledge, and the experiences of how this work is done and what makes a difference in the lives of children and families. And not enough of your voices are being heard in the places where decisions are being made. So if there's one message that I can give you today, it is to understand. Irving used to talk about the baby in the river, and someone runs in, takes the baby to the side, and then he looks up, there's another baby, and this goes on for a while, and finally he says to his friends, "You go grab the baby, and starts running up the river." And someone says, "Where are you going?" He says, "I'm going to see who's throwing the babies in the river and stop them." So I have taken that one step further when I talk to funders, and I'm going to say this to you too, which is to say, our foundation sits, we're trying to improve the likelihood that all children and families, especially those from disenfranchised communities, receive equal access to comprehensive high-quality care and nurturing environments from birth, because we want them to be successful. That's a huge ambition, right? And to do that, we have to get at the root causes of what's creating the problems. But there's a need all along the riverbank for people to go in the river at different phases and do the work that's most meaningful for them. Whether that's delivery of services right on the spot when a child needs it, or it's in the training and the leadership development of the workforce, or it's in the policy or the systems work of really trying to change the way our country delivers services, or it's in the funding mechanisms for how that's done. There's many, many different ways to think about it, and there's a role for everyone to play along the river. But what there isn't a role for is someone to just play their own role without understanding the people above and below them on the river and the relationship that you have to each other. So what I'm going to say to you today is that it's critically important that you understand where you are in the river, do that as best as you can, and then figure out how to connect to those people who are above you and below you on the river to make your knowledge and resources and expertise available to inform their work too. So that's my big message. I could stop right now. We could be done. I will quickly go through a couple slides, but I really want to give you guys some time. We have a number of goals. I will highlight them to say we want to narrow the achievement gap, the mental health gap, the policy gap between what we know from science and research, like we heard today, and what our policies actually support. And we want to narrow the equity and access gap in reproductive health and justice, which is not an area I'll focus on today. But I will say, because this is a public health conference, our foundation works at the intersection of all of these disciplines: health, mental health, reproductive health and justice, early learning, early intervention, all the different systems that touch children and families' lives. And our work is about integrating those systems so that we can get to the kinds of outcomes we want to see for children and families, because there's no silver bullet, as you all know, and it's going to take a more seamless set of services and systems for children and families. We use a number of strategies. We emphasize 0-3. We focus particularly on social emotional development and mental health services in the context of child and family serving systems, from the prevention to the treatment continuum. And we do that because so many other foundations are in the other spaces, and very few have historically been in the mental health space. It seems to be challenging to get funders to enter that space from a philanthropic point of view, but to get attention focused on it. So you'll often see a mental health department, but they won't have very young children as a value in their system. We have that here in Illinois. Our work is to try to get them to change that. We do a lot of our strategies, our leadership development and training, and a big emphasis for this work around child trauma has been the Harris Professional Development Network, an investment we've made for 25 years and 18 leadership organizations around the country. we do the development, and through that and through other grants and partnership with our grantees, we develop and replicate innovative model programs, but always to meet a particular gap and need in the field, and always with a sustainability strategy. You have to be thinking about that from the beginning. So you started a program, but how can that get supported and lifted up? If we find it's working, how do we get others to want to do it and support it and pay for it? So from the beginning, you should be thinking about that. Of course, we would be nowhere if we couldn't leverage public resources. So a huge amount of our work is focused on policy advocacy and systems building, and then we do a whole lot of other kinds of work. And we give grants, but we also do field leadership, because so much of the work that I do and the time I spend is allowing our grantees to do their work through grant making and partnering with them, but also serving and being on a number of different committees. And so I'm going to get the slides that focus on that, but I'm not going to spend my time because I want you guys to have time for questions. We do a lot to leverage our funding and our expertise to maximize public-private relationships, and we, because of course in any good early childhood program, you have to engage in relationship-based work. So much of what we do is around relationships. So this is a slide I will spend some time on because I want you to find yourselves on here. You may not be able to read it so well. A lot of what we heard about today is here, right? We all are in the service of children and families and making that relationship between child and families as healthy as possible. And I want to just reference my colleagues in Colorado. This is taken from your new work that you've done around a mental health action plan in Colorado. We're doing a similar one here in Illinois, and some other states have done it. Ours is designed in Illinois to fit into the larger action plan and goals for young children and families. I believe yours is also in Colorado. So this idea was taken a bit from them. But we all want this relationship to thrive. To do that, you need to have well-trained caregivers who support that relationship and who themselves are supported. My work is here. How do we get the workforce with the capacity and the knowledge and the skills that we need? Where should we be embedding training in higher education or in community colleges? How do we get career lattices and other pieces put in place? How do we get credentials and certification and things like that put in place so that we can drive a workforce? What's the supply and demand side of that? What do we need to change in order for systems to say, yes, this is worth training people, and yes, we need to pay them? So we all know we all get underpaid in this field, particularly in the early childhood workforce. So my work is there, but that's in service of this work here. And then, of course, here, it's the promotion, prevention, intervention, and treatment continuum. So how do we, my work is here, your work is somewhere probably along here, but you need to understand that what you're doing in your system impacts what's going on in the court systems, in the child welfare systems, in the school system, in the child care system. My work is to figure out, how do we align those? How do they work in support of each other? How do we more effectively use the resources in those systems, as scarce as they may be, to be as effective as possible? And what could your role be in helping to connect to and leverage those resources in the pediatric community and elsewhere in the service of this dyad here? And then, of course, our public sector partners, local, state, federal systems. For very young children, a lot of the funding comes from the feds to the states. It's a little bit different when you've got older kids. And so how does that work? What does our relationship have to be? How do those systems talk to each other? And all of this goes to a vision that's very similar to our vision, right? And I'm sure it's similar to yours. If you can see this on the outside, what you have is, this requires good data and research, and we heard about some really important research today, but data collection is important. Public awareness, which is an area we haven't done quite as much in, but somebody mentioned earlier they're starting to see a bit of a change, as am I, I'm hopeful, around this notion of trauma and the important impact. I think ACEs has had to do a lot with that. The notion of preschool expulsions, which I'm going to touch on, was shocking data. I think it got some people in Washington thinking, and of course, all in the service of policy. So if there's one thing I want you to take away, this is the river, but it's done like in a circular motion. It's not a whirlpool, I promise. And I think that's something that we can think about where we sit. We talked a little bit about our Paris PDN. It started really about the workforce. We wanted to do this work. Nobody was trained. We found leaders in the field. Irving did. I wasn't around then. 20 years ago I started, but 25 years ago. And we invested in their ability to develop curriculum, to think about what does somebody who works on traumatic issues with young children through a clinical point of view and frame need to know. And over the years, as the field has grown, so has this work, to the development and replication of innovative model programs, to work informing systems of services, whether that's foster care, child welfare, courts, and how to bring trauma-informed lenses to the work that they do. That's been helped through applied research, and of course, all in the service of systems. And then beyond PDN, we do a lot of work with our public partners, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this slide, but know that we very intentionally pick off a number of child and family serving systems and partner with them. And we'll, like, for instance, here in Illinois, we've been replicating CPP through a learning collaborative model where we are partnering with child welfare agencies across the state to train their workforce. And we do that with DCFS here and say, look, we'll pay for the training if you support the service delivery. So we'll often try to do a public-private partnership, and we'll be very strategic about which agencies we use and which agencies we work with. And the philanthropic sector can bring that kind of training, but we want the public sector to pay for the services. So that's just an example. But we do similar work within the home visiting sectors, within early learning, and in child welfare. We were very instrumental here informing our decision to do a trauma-informed set of services and study through our waiver system. And we also worked in advocacy ways federally to get the waivers in place to begin with. We do a lot of public-private leveraging work where we try to say, there's this big federal initiative, it's the Early Learning Challenge. How can we make sure mental health is embedded in those conversations when we do our state plan? We're doing that right now with the Child Care Development Block Grants. You should all know this. There's a new reauthorization, and in the Child Care Development Block Grant language from the feds, state plans have to include some language around social-emotional development of young children and are encouraged to even create an expulsion policy, a suspension and expulsion policy for preschool. Who better to inform that than all of you? Who better to make sure that the state, as they write this plan, which will set the vision for the state for childcare for young children, birth through five, includes something like that? And that the language the feds are encouraging is that it includes mental health consultation and other kinds of supports, and that we should have a zero policy for expulsion. Because what's shocking is child care and preschools expel three times the rate of K-12 education. And we know that expulsion leads to future expulsion, and we are setting our kids up for long-term challenges. So that's a wonderful opportunity right now in your own states to get involved or to find advocates and get them involved. Okay. We talked about field leadership. I currently co-chair our state's Early Learning Council. That's a wonderful other place for you to go and see if they have different committees that are focusing on these issues. We do in our state, and we do bring a lot of expertise to bear on that. As I mentioned, the CCDBG reauthorization is an opportunity right now. We have other opportunities in our state that we're working on, and that's where you could bring your voice and your expertise. And as I said earlier, it's really all because what you want is this. You want the engagement and the caregiver in a secure relationship. So everything is about this, and it's important for us to remember that we too can have a role in helping to do that and bring your expertise, bring your resources to bear, whether they're financial, like in California, or they're your expertise or they're your field leadership. But I urge you not to just sit in your therapeutic space, but to figure out how what I'm doing can be heard and help to inform the way policies are being written, because at the end of the day, what gets funded is what's in that state plan, or it's in the vision, or it's because, there's administrative rule changes that have huge impacts, and there's also big policy legislative impacts that are a heavier lift. So there's lots of ways to inform and make an impact through policy. So I'm going to stop. I know I did that quickly, but I want at least 10 minutes for you guys to ask all of the experts here questions. So I am going to sit down, but thank you for your time.
Thank you. if I could add one minor thing to Phyllis's excellent presentation and the incredible work they're doing, I think all of us who are interested in public health and public policy have to be aware there can be setbacks. You get something initiated and it can be turned around. We've seen two recently. We had worked into our state budget the opportunity to continue the Harris program that we're doing perpetually. Last year, in a cost-cutting measure, as our governor slashed programs, one of the things that got slashed in our budget was the infant mental health program. And we also had worked with the Medicaid providers not only to join training throughout the state in child parent psychotherapy, but for a different cost basis, a different provider basis for those trained in child parent psychotherapy, the governor appointed a new group of Medicaid overseers. We have to educate them. I'm reminded a little bit, I always think of Irving's wonderful story about the fish, about the river and the kid in the river, but I also think of one of my grandchildren's favorite nursery poems about the itsy bitsy spider climbed up the water spout, down came the rain and washed the spider out. Out came the sun and dried the rain away, and the itsy bitsy spider climbed up the spout again. And so for many of us who work in public policy, it's also the recognition that things can change with different leaders, but the more we persevere and have the knowledge and the ability to convince, and we've been doing this lately with a new, very conservative Republican senator who wants to build 0-3 now into mental health initiatives. But the more we do this, the greater likelihood is it becomes part of the culture and so culturally ingrained that we will be able to have sustainability and the type of sustainability that helps throughout. Let me turn to questions for all of our superb panelists. We tried to make sure there would be time for them. Yes?
I just want to say this was a phenomenal session, and I'm just saying that because I work with Dr. O'Donnell, this was really quite wonderful. My question is around, I think it was Dr. Ghosh-Ifman's presentation about policy. And so I thought that you made a provocative statement, which is provocative to me, around there needing to be policies around mandatory reporting and creating the space for parents to feel comfortable talking. And so I'm curious about yours, as well as the judge's perspective, and of course others, about what that type of policy would look like, or what it should look like.
And may I mention Dr. Bruckner's key role? She is the chair of the coordinating commission for the Gulf Region Health Outreach Program, which is 9 projects established by the federal court as part of the medical settlement following the oil spill. Most are public health, and there are 4 that are mental health, but it's been a marvelous collaboration, coalition building, and we're all working on a paper together about that coalition, and I know she'll be speaking later on as well. But can we go on to her question?
So a great example was in California, you think about whether or not you have to report domestic violence. And there's policy at the agency level where some agencies flat out say yes, you have to report. Whereas for us, the mandate is that we don't actually have to report past history of domestic violence unless the child has actually been injured. That means that parents can come and talk to me about domestic violence, and we can think about how it might affect children's emotions. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Now, also, I think clinicians have leeway, and if the parent says we had a fight, you know, thinking about, and the child watched it, am I thinking about, I have the ability to report, is it voluntary, but is it mandatory? And so we very loudly just on this domestic violence, whether a family would be safe talking about it. Domestic violence prevalence in this country is 1 out of 5, just to put it out there. So having your largest public health epidemic being interpersonal violence, and having, you know, clinic policies or state-level policies, because there's some states where you actually have a mandated report no matter what. So I love that in California we have leeway. Interesting that when I consult around the country, I always have to ask, so in your state you have to report. And as we see that families don't feel safe to talk about it, it's actually easier for us to work with the child welfare population because the information is out there. And so we have parents coming forward. It's easier to work with former substance abusers because they also have, you know, they're saying these things happen. And we need those kinds of, so could we partner together to say, well, if a family is coming for treatment, how would we partner to be able to say that they can talk about past experiences that they're coming for treatment, unless they're sort of so egregious, you know, that, you know, it would involve ritual abuse or something over sexual abuse, but we're really concerned that safety is not in place, so that parents can feel safe talking about. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
We also have the issue of when families come and they're talking about abuse, if you say that your child, that when you were a child, you were abused by your mother, and your mother is now taking care of your child, we have a mandated abuse report. And of course, the mother has really changed, but you never know who you're going to get as a child welfare worker and what's going to happen. And the truth is that the lens varies depending on what the family looks like sometimes, in terms of the judgments that happen. And so even when there is a policy in place, the way that policy plays out is very uneven in terms of whether it results in systems involvement. And that is a lot of families not engaged. So I'm bringing up a lot of the issues, but can you see how we might think about clinic policies that allow you to talk about certain topics? And then if we're partnering with CCSF, how you might be able to have a waiver
It's also critical, because our interviews are going to have to be recorded, that DCFS uses trauma-informed practices, and that they become also a less threatening agency, and that you explicitly, as you talked about, identify how these people are going to respond to having DCFS in their lives. So DCFS now is everywhere, should be transforming also in that advocate for that.
Can I also make a comment as it relates to the family and as it relates to the judicial system? So one of the things, of course, that also happens and happens across the country is that there is a domestic violence charge and the child is traumatized and the judge rules visitation, and sometimes it's not supervised visitation. And so those of us who are clinicians are dealing with these children who go to visitation, get traumatized over and over again in that circumstance. And so as Phyllis and Molly and Chandra and I were all talking about the systems integration, it's extremely important to have trauma-informed systems for the sake of the child and the family.
And I would just add that there's always going to be the juggling, and each state is going to be different as it applies to permissive or mandatory reporting, as well as the HIPAA requirements and the state's separate confidentiality requirements. And it's an education process. You have to keep teaching the legal profession, because there are still judges and lawyers that believe unless the baby is physically touched during a domestic violence episode, then it really doesn't matter. You know, unless the baby was bruised during the slugfest, it doesn't matter. That child didn't experience trauma. So getting all players on board with trauma-informed care, seeing things through a trauma-informed lens, because we're never going to be experts in this field, but to understand that it plays that role. And I always go back to relationships. In one of our Safe Babies Court Team cases, we had the ultimate A-team in delivery of services. We had a young woman who happened to be a Katrina survivor, and she was so damaged. She was a child herself, had a child. And during a hearing involving her, when our community coordinator and our therapist, our CPT therapist and her individual therapist testified, were the only time she made eye contact with anyone. During the rest of the hearing, which went on for hours, they were face down on the table. But because of the connection that she felt, the way she was treated by Eileen and by Judy, she sat up and she made eye contact and she smiled. And she had the courage to go on because people believed in her. Because even if we're not successful, as I said, you know, just because I have to terminate parental rights doesn't mean we give up. They're going to have more babies. And maybe those seeds will have been planted and nurtured enough that they can be successful in the future.
Yes, we'll have one more at least. I know we're running.
Okay,
please.
We fund a lot of programs, but getting that integration piece, is really difficult, and also getting enrolled there, getting recognized there as a enrolled learner. We do, like, you know, I feel like we're making a small crack in the problem in urban areas, but in urban or rural areas or tribal areas where it's so prevalent. I mean, we can't get people to go out here to provide services. So it's, you know,
I will apologize as the moderator. I know we could go on. I deliberately left less time for discussion because in some of the plenaries I've been, there were only one or two questions. And so they dismissed the session early. And I felt I wanted us to have a full session today. But obviously with the wonderful group we have here, we could have gone on indefinitely with interactive discussion as well. But I think we should probably call it to an end unless to give time for the next session to begin. But unless there's one other comment people want to make, I'm going to thank you all very much for what I think has been a series of excellent presentations and questions. Thank you.